The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian World Cup Football Daily. Day 9, the day where Brazil arrived just about. Two injury time goals see off Costa Rica as Neymar is really quite annoying. In the same group, the wonderful calves of Jerdan Shaqiri power him through for a last minute winner against Serbia. The first game where a team has come from behind to win this tournament. And Iceland are favourites for the first time in a match and they don't live up to it. Ahmed Musa inspires Nigeria to victory. Elsewhere, we'll look ahead to tomorrow's games. And there's a choice of lyrics for Barry to close the show with his delicate Irish lilt. And that, everyone, is the Guardian World Cup Football Daily. Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hello.
You had a day off.
I did.
Did you drink?
I did.
I'm going to still want to swear at you. Paolo Bandini, how are you?
I'm good.
Lovely to see you.
Good to see you.
We have a full set today. Philippe Auclair. I want to watch more football matches with you, Philippe.
Why is that, Max?
Because there's swearing and there's excitement whenever there's a shot. There is a question here from Auriel, Philippe, that says, Is the World Cup to football like Eurovision is to music? Think about it, he says. The music is terrible, but you watch it because it's interesting to see nations against each other, and England's song is always bad.
No.
You disagree?
I disagree entirely.
But you did come in this afternoon saying how terrible you found this entire experience.
No, I didn't find the experience terrible. Okay. There's a distinction.
I'm misquoting you, apologies.
Yeah, no, I thought that the technical level of most of the games was actually very, very poor, and that we were a bit fooled by the fact that there were full stadiums and they were wearing those lovely shirts, and that should we see that on the championship ground, we might actually ask for our money back.
Sounds like the Eurovision to me. Lovely
but the
shirts,
difference,
big
the difference,
full house, but poor quality.
But the difference would be that I actually think that England have been one of the better teams of the tournament so far. So, and I wouldn't give them 0 points.
But arguably Graham Norton would be better than some of the commentators that we have. So Brazil 2, Costa Rica 0. Injury time winners, I was praying for Costa Rica to hold out. Paolo, what did you make of it?
I thought that there was a whole heap of nonsense towards the end of the game. I thought Douglas Costa was game-changing, as he often was for Juventus in the second half of the season. It's such a sort of strange situation there at Brazil, because I mean, even Argentina, who have this sort of excess of attacking talent, don't have it to the same extent that Brazil do, where you think, all right, you know, Neymar is supposed to be the guy, but you've got Firmino, who in my opinion had one of the best seasons of any forward anywhere in Europe on the bench, and Douglas Costa, who was in my opinion the single most important player again the second half of the season for Juventus on the bench. The options to change games for them are so strong. And actually, really, the end of this game reminded me quite a lot of the end of the game against Switzerland when they were piling on. The difference was that this time they found a way through. And I think, you know, for me, I feel like it's you know, more exciting this way. I think this Brazil team has, over two games, played well enough to feel like it deserved to win a game somewhere in there. I think that the end of the game was... Costa Rica were really time-wasting. I understand why, but they were really time-wasting in a way that was quite over the top. I'm sure little sympathy in lots of quarters given how Neymar was flopping about and happily, you know, being correctly identified, making a big deal of a penalty call that was then taken away from him. But I think Brazil deserve to win the game. They've still got more to do to get out of the group after what happened later on. But yeah, I think they deserve to win the game.
Barry, was that the most interesting piece of VAR so far?
I wouldn't say it was particularly interesting, but it was. I found it quite funny because it happened to Neymar. Referees, when they toddle off to look at the screen, sort of feel obliged to overturn the decision to make their trudge to the sideline worthwhile. But that was a brave decision and the correct decision, because Neymar, you know, was play-acting. He made an awful meal of the non-challenge, just a hand on his chest, and he sort of threw himself backwards as if he'd been shot. But, yeah, it was good to see.
Neymar suffered four fouls, the most of any on the pitch. He also committed four fouls, the most of any player on the pitch. Father Michael asks, Philippe, after today's performance, does Neymar jump straight to the top of the bastard of the tournament ladder?
I think Lucas Hernandez still is top of the bastard ladder, I think.
Above Pepe?
Oh, Pepe's hors de concours, and has always been. It's been for a few years. But in terms of, maybe Neymar. Yeah, I
don't his tears.
So
at
it's
the
minus
end.
minus seven fouls on Neymar compared to the first game. I think he had 11 fouls against him. But what does count as a foul against Neymar?
It's a good question. I suppose Barami wasn't playing for Costa Rica. He was busy, wasn't he? the tears of Neymar. Now, I'm not a cynical man, but I don't think he was crying, Paolo. Is that bad of me?
I don't know. Look, I think it's you know, realistic and legitimate to say that Neymar does have an extraordinary, not unique, because there are a few other players you could think of in this tournament, but an extraordinary level of pressure on him as sort of a player who is now very much sort of viewed as the symbol of that team. And I can see how you would have an emotional release from a situation where you genuinely thought you were about to draw a second game and a second, which would have really left them in a very difficult spot going into this last round of games. At the same time, of course, I don't think that people are going to feel that sympathetic to him, because a lot of that pressure is invited. I mean, he is someone who strives to put himself at the centre of our attention. I mean, he's already on to his second haircut of the tournament. We're only on game two, so he's got a high bar he set for himself there. A shorter bar. I mean, that's the only problem I worry for him, is he's taken so much off, he's left himself not that much, you know, space to manoeuvre now.
If you keep having haircuts, it's only one way it's going to go.
Yeah. Well, you can have hair extensions.
True. Wouldn't that be fabulous?
That's probably the next stage of the Neymarization is hair extensions.
He looks like Ivanov or someone. I mean, to be fair, Barry, to Brazil, they created a bucket load in the second half. Keylor Navas played very well for Costa Rica, and they could have won it much earlier, couldn't they?
They deserve to win. I just on the discussion of Neymar, this may be absolute lunacy on my part. Is there a case to be made that, say, if Neymar was injured or got a red card and suspended, Brazil would be better off without him?
Well, that's the question I was asking myself when Paulo was talking about the fact that Douglas Costa couldn't get in that team, that Roberto Firmino, whom I think all of us would agree, I think most people would agree, has genuinely been one of the best number nines on the planet, and is still making a big difference when he comes on. You think, yes, they would be better balanced, and also perhaps there would be less pressure. I mean, I don't know. This pressure is entirely self-inflicted. If he, you know, actually crying at the end of the game is only going to add to the pressure, because people will look at it and think this is absolutely pathetic.
Or pretending to cry.
Yeah, pretending to cry. And it, everybody will be going, you know, you'll be going all Smokey Robinson about it. It's because it's ridiculous. It's a circus act. And also he makes absolutely sure everybody sees him, and it's going to be about him. And it's just unbearable. Absolutely unbearable. What I'm wondering is how the other players in the team are living this. Because has he pulled his weight for the team so far?
Yeah, I mean,
yes,
goal was the fluff, and you know they'd already got the goal that mattered. He also pulled off that that flick over the defender at point as well. It was a bit. It did feel like he sort of was doing his. And now the YouTube highlight reel after the first goal had gone in, which, in fairness to him, given there was only, 4 minutes of injury time left at that point, good luck to him squeezing that in to that spot. But, yeah.
I wonder if there's a difference between four middle-aged men, as I'd class us, being annoyed with Neymar doing that flick, and...
I'm not.
Are you not annoyed?
No.
Okay.
I really enjoyed it.
Oh, fair enough. Maybe you're down with the kids. I just wonder if teenagers kids would watch that and just be so delighted to say, oh, that's fantastic.
I also don't know if I'd say I was annoyed with it. I just think that it's sort of an irrelevance. What's incredible is when you do something like that and it's 0-0 and then you score. You know, what's incredible is doing that at a point of a game where it matters. It's impressive. You know, it's still sort of, wow, that's, you know, a stunt that not everyone can pull off. But it doesn't carry the same weight to me when it's deep in injury time and the game is kind of already settled.
A word on Costa Rica. What have they delivered for the World Cup, Barry?
Very little.
And they're out.
They've lost
have
two games.
Have we mentioned that they're out?
Yeah, they're gone.
They're
yeah,
gone. They That's it. What's Goodbye.
That? O Globo in Brazil are leading their coverage with an opinion piece entitled, "It is not normal to cry in the second game of the World Cup." Interesting.
So well, you saw the front pages of Brazilian newspapers after Brazil's first game.
There was the one set of front pages I didn't
read. It was
really,
actually quite brutal.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I think actually over the top in a way. I mean, actually completely over the top.
I mean, I think that's actually a really important point, though. So if we take it that he isn't faking it, if these are genuine tears, then I think you have to ask a very serious question about whether someone who is feeling that emotional at this point of the tournament can manage his emotions through what's going to get a lot more intense in the weeks ahead. I mean, that's a serious question for Brazil,
and,
in my
and
opinion.
And I think the Brazilians would also feel, remember, you know, the feelings before the game against Germany, which is, and I think probably in their history, the second most traumatic game after the loss against Uruguay in 1950. Then you've got the loss against Germany in the World Cup in 2014, where the players simply emotionally just couldn't cope with it. So, yeah, I mean, one way or another, it's not good at all.
Costa Rica's defeat means that of the five Argentinian managers at the World Cup, Sampaoli, Jose Pekerman, Colombia, Ricardo Gareca, Peru, Hector Cooper, Egypt, and Juan Pizzi of Saudi Arabia, they've managed 9 games between them. They have 1 draw and 8 defeats. It's a staggering statistic. So for Qatar 2022, if any football federations are listening, I would avoid an Argentinian manager. Now, also in that group, the game we just have just seen, which actually turned out to be a very good game, yeah, and I don't think indeed any of us expected it to be that good a game, was Serbia 1, Switzerland 2. And as I said in the intro, the first team to come from behind. And it obviously meant a lot to the players of Kosovan origin, Granit Xhaka, Sheldon Shaqiri, who both scored, and Valen Bourami as well. Nick Ames wrote a really good piece about that whole story yesterday. But this, Barry, was a great football match, actually.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And my hopes weren't particularly high before it started. And, you know, that's the good thing about the World Cup. You sit down and watch a game and you're not expecting a great deal and you get a real thriller. And I think that was a thriller. Mitrovic, I can't decide whether he's really good or really bad. He scored a good goal and missed a bucket full of chances. Should have had a penalty when he was wrestled to the ground by Lichtsteiner and another defender. I can't remember who it was.
It was tag team wrestling,
yeah, and
wasn't it?
You know, that the VAR officials seem to be ignoring those wrestling, grappling in the box during corners or free kicks. And I'm not sure why. You know, we obviously had it with Harry Kane as well. But, yeah, Switzerland seemed to have settled for the draw, really, which would have meant they'd need to beat Costa Rica, I think, by 3 or 4 goals in their final game. And just a brilliant winner by Jordan Shaqiri following some ridiculously daft defending from Tosic, who had earlier missed a very good chance with a header. Ball flashed across the face of goal. He should have got his head to it and buried it and missed it completely. And then he seemed to forget the offside rule because he tried to play Shaqiri on offside, even though Shaqiri had picked up the ball in his own half and couldn't be offside. So, and then when he realised his error, went on the chase, but Shaqiri beat him for speed and slotted home a lovely finish.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's loads of interesting stuff to pick up in this game. I just wanted to come back before we move on to it to that Mitrovic foul, because a thing that I was looking at earlier in the tournament, and I know the numbers from the start of the day. I don't know what they are now at the end of the day because I haven't a chance to retally. But before the start of today, I think it was 26 out of 51 goals in this World Cup have been scored from set pieces. And that's like wildly out of step with previous tournaments. Like last World Cup, 30 out of 171 were, so that's 17.5%. This year, we're looking at more than half of goals coming from set pieces. And in general, the trend has been also against that. I mean, I've said that, you know, 17.5% at the last World Cup, it's been going down. Like 2002 was 28%, 2010 was 24%. The trend has been to have fewer goals coming from set pieces tournament. The theory for why there have been more, VAR, there's been a lot of penalties this tournament, but one of the theories I'd heard sort of put to me is that actually defenders were doing less of this at corners because they'd been warned VAR is going to pick you up. Like, if you grab the striker, you're going to get penalised for it. So part of the theory of why we're getting more set-piece goals is people are going, oh, you know what, let it be. And yet now we have the Tunisia game in which Harry Kane was sort of blatantly manhandled and nothing happened. And we have this game. So I don't know, it's just sort of an interesting counter to that idea that, that VAR is picking this up. I mean, the Mitrovic one, and look, in many ways it would have been, I think, a bit of a travesty if Serbia had won this game by then, because Switzerland was so much better in the second half. But it was a stonewall penalty. It was absolutely indisputable.
It seems to be the blind spot, though, of VAR, which seems to be doing trips very well, handballs pretty well. I think the Denmark-Australia one was pretty unlucky. But this is a blind spot for VAR.
I mean, there's an important thing to say here, which we can talk about the VAR aspect of it. The referee and linesman between them should have seen this. This was not something that was, you know, only VAR could see. It was right in the middle of the penalty area.
And it was also happening in the direction of play. It was not one of the things which was happening out of the field of vision, because you always follow the ball. Well, the ball was going exactly that way towards Mitrovic, so everybody could see it. It was a bit like, not a rugby union, but kind of rugby league tackle. Mm. You know, when the guy just receives the ball and runs forward to make a yard, and then he's tackled by two people. That was exactly it.
Mitrovic should have picked up the ball and rolled it back.
For a start, he should have done the worm for about 5 seconds with people lying on top of him.
But if there are so many goals scored from set pieces, why are they employing Argentinians and not Tony Pulis?
It's a very good point. Sampaoli might get sacked, mightn't he? And then Pulis could feasibly come in. And actually, he could win the World Cup, couldn't he?
Absolutely.
We should mention the celebration that both Xhaka and Shaqiri did.
Yes, which might lend them into some trouble.
But it
perhaps
might. It's the celebration they did, the Albanian eagle. So that's on the flag of Albania.
For the benefit of those who can't see what's happening, Max is at the moment utterly failing to do the Albanian eagle.
This is it.
I'm guessing shadow puppetry isn't your forte.
I put it on my CV just in case when I went for the Blue Peter gig.
The two-headed eagle.
Yes, and it's Kosovo's used that in the 1990s to show resistance to Serbia. Granit Xhaka has Albanian parents, and his father was in prison for 3.5 years when he was 22 for demonstrating against communist Yugoslavian rule in Kosovo. The piece that Nick Ames writes also had a piece of Shaqiri, and that he has a
Kosovo
flag,
yes,
embroidered into his boot, I think it is.
Yeah, his right boot.
So a great deal of meaning for those players. Shaqiri was, apart from the goal, I mean, he had one glorious strike, didn't he? I mean, there was you know when football's exciting when you all make the same sort of involuntary noise. And we all did it when that curling shot hit the stanchion. He's a wonderful player.
He's been absolutely terrific and also unbelievably frustrating as Granit Xhaka as well is, who scored an absolutely glorious, glorious goal, managing to hit that spinning the ball, which was like a spinning top onto the in the corner. What you wonder is that were Shaqiri and Xhaka, both of whom had excellent games, this kind of extraordinary personal investment they had in playing against Serbia, which obviously meant an awful lot, will they reproduce that in Switzerland's next games? Switzerland now has a good chance of actually topping the group, which is extraordinary. If they beat Costa Rica, which you would imagine, Costa Rica is basically on the plane home, you would imagine them having a good result against them, which will be on Wednesday.
And it makes the Serbia-Brazil game as well.
It's going to be fascinating. Yeah.
Really interesting. I mean, Serbia have got to get... Serbia, before Switzerland scored that goal, you
Brazil
wondered...
could go out.
Yeah.
That's an astonishing thing. Serbia could beat Brazil and Brazil could go out. Mm-hmm.
What do you want to happen, Barry?
It's a tough one.
I'm here to ask the tough questions.
Yeah, you've left me stumped. I think I'd prefer to see Brazil go through, just because Serbia helped eliminate Ireland and I'm still bitter about that.
Fair enough. Interestingly, none of the first 26 matches at this tournament have ended 0-0.
That's truly remarkable.
Yeah.
No World Cup has gone longer without seeing a goalless draw matching 1954. There wasn't VAR in 1954.
I think also, if I'm not mistaken, insofar as the goals per game ratio, this is the lowest scoring World Cup ever.
Even
and yet we haven't had a 0-0 draw.
Even including 1990?
It's a stat I read somewhere today,
Do you not have all the ratios?
Presumably on Twitter, and I'm taking it at face value. I haven't checked.
But
I think it might have been Miguel Delaney, who's a fairly reputable source. He doesn't get much wrong.
Paolo?
Well, there's another one that I got off Miguel Delaney, because we all should have picked up, but I didn't think of it. First, although no 0-0 draws, this is the first game in the World Cup a team has come from behind to win.
As I mentioned in the intro, Paolo wasn't listening to, clearly.
I mean, when it comes to...
I think you said it twice.
I did, yeah.
This Brazil-Serbia game, I mean, one thing to look forward to is I'd really love to see Douglas Costa against Branislav Ivanovic.
Yeah.
That could be great fun.
I've never seen Douglas Costa have a bad game, actually. I haven't seen him play that many times. just before we end part one, interesting to note that the Serbia-Switzerland game was the first game where a team came from behind to win.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
That's remarkable. Anyway, 26 games.
Yeah, so something to tell your friends in the pub tomorrow night. Mm-hmm. And that'll do for part one. In part two, we will talk about Nigeria's victory over Iceland. Welcome to part two of the Guardian World Cup Football Daily. Nigeria 2, Iceland 0. Let's speak to the Nigerian football expert, Anu Adeoye. Anu, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm great, Max.
Big surprise for me, certainly, after the performance in your first game. Was it a surprise to you?
Tell you what, it was a surprise for me too. I didn't see that coming.
I read your Twitter, and the first thing that struck out was, Ahmed Musa has given me more joy than all our elected officials combined.
And I tell you, that's true, because let's not delve into the politics, but we've not had a good time of late, and Ahmed Musa seems to find his best form during the World Cup, because 4 years ago against Argentina, he scored 2 goals, and now with 2 now, he's our highest goal scorer in World Cup history with 4. 2 more than his nearest challenger. So I think there's something about the World Cup that brings the best out of Ahmed Musa.
Do you think Iceland underestimated you?
I wouldn't say so, because in the first half, it was a really poor first half. We both lacked a little cutting edge in the final third. And they missed a few chances towards the end of the first half. Although, to everyone's surprise, we coped well with their set pieces. Aaron Gunnarsson, he had some long throws that had me praying and stuff. But I don't think they underrated us, because that would have been striking if they had underrated us.
Anu, Nigeria played a different system in this game, 3 at the back, and John Obi Mikel was, you know, in a deeper role where he was sort of playing as a number 10 in their opening game, and it just didn't work. Pretty brave and sensible changes by the manager.
Yeah, he was. And it was a surprise too, because in his press conference yesterday, his pretty much press conference, he gave the impression he wasn't going to change anything. He said, oh, we conceded some goals, some stupid goals. It wasn't a matter of organization. So he threw everyone off balance. But everybody has been clamoring for a return to the back three, because if you watch the game against England at Wembley, first half we played a flat back four, it didn't work. And then he changed to a back three, brought on Kenneth Omero to play with our two Onyibos, as we call them, William Tristekong and Leon Balogun. And it worked really well. And then when Tyron Ebuehi came in at the start of the second half as wing backs with Victor Moses, who plays as a wing back for Chelsea too, he worked a treat. And the other surprising thing our manager did was Alex Iwobi dropped out, because Alex Iwobi was poor in the first game against Croatia. It wasn't his fault. He should have been playing centrally rather than playing out wide. And then our main striker, Odion Ighalo, who has lost a yard of pace since moving to China, he dropped out too. So we had Kelechi Iheanacho and Ahmed Musa, two very mobile strikers. And I think that surprised the Icelandic team a little bit. It was good stuff from our manager.
Anu, at the end of the match, it looked like Mikel may have broken his wrist. Have you heard anything further on that?
We haven't heard anything yet, because we're waiting. You probably have to undergo a scan and all. But I hope he can play on Tuesday against Argentina, because he is a very important player to how we play and set up.
I saw on your Twitter as well that when Nigeria concede a penalty, all the fans chant in unison, over the bar, over the bar.
Yeah, that's true. We turn it into a chant, over the bar, over the bar. So if you attend a Nigerian Football League game, If the opponent gets a penalty, that is what the fans chant. It's like a form of prayer.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And it worked.
And it absolutely worked a treat, didn't it? Poor old Gylfi Sigurdsson.
It worked this time round. I think the ball just landed in Lagos.
Argentina next. A lot of the coverage has been how good this result is for Argentina, but it's better for you, isn't it?
It's better for us because let's not forget, we played Argentina in Krasnodar in November, was it? And we beat them 4-2. The only thing, Messi didn't play, fine. But Messi hasn't played in this World Cup either, so... I'm not.
Dangerous words.
Look, he might decide to turn up and score 3 past us and all, but we should be confident because as Nigerians, we are fond of doing the mathematics of how does this favor us. And I've looked at the numbers and all we need is a draw and hope Croatia avoid a 3-goal defeat against Iceland, which I don't... It looks doable, to be honest.
And what will the atmosphere be like in Nigeria tonight?
Oh, it's going to be a party. In Lagos today, like during rush hour, it's always, how do I describe it? You know how rush hour is. It's always filled up with traffic and stuff. But today, everybody was watching the game. Either you left the office on time or you watched it in your office and the road was free. There was barely traffic. And tonight, it's a party atmosphere in Lagos.
Hey, great to talk to you, Anu. We'll talk to you again. If you beat Argentina, please come back on.
We will beat Argentina or get a draw.
Oh, I like your confidence. Anu Adeoye, their Nigerian football expert. I don't know if I occasionally forget how brilliant a World Cup is, and sometimes you need to talk to someone who's just whose team have just won to just get that pure joy, don't you, Paolo?
Yeah, absolutely. That was a very joyful conversation, wasn't it? Yeah, that's what I love about the World Cup. It feels sort of trite to say it, and we should all be more cool and knowing than this. But one of the best things about a World Cup is just knowing that you're sharing an experience with someone who is, not someone, with millions of people who are living in completely different countries, different experiences to you, but you're sharing the experience of watching the football with them in some way. Yeah,
196 million of them in the case of Nigeria.
There you go.
Do you think Iceland felt the pressure of being... I mean,
the thing, were they genuinely favourites? I mean,
maybe they just were in my head.
They were quite... Well,
they were fancy.
In terms of bookies' odds, they were warm favourites, but not red-hot favourites by any stretch of the imagination. And I don't think they were played terribly. You know, Iceland are a brilliantly organised team. You watch them move around the pitch, it's like they're a foosball team. You know, you could put a bar through them. They're two perfect lines.
No spinning,
back.
Though.
No, not allowed to spin. That's unethical.
But I like the idea of Sigurdsson and just going round, four of them, whole midfield, just spinning round and round. Anyway,
do you remember what is the tactical formation of what we call le baby foot in French?
It is
2 at the back,
2-5-3.
Yeah.
But I thought Kenneth O'Meara, who Anu mentioned there. Centre half for Nigeria was excellent, and I only found out during the game from the commentary. He's 24 years old. He's been at Chelsea for 5 or 6 years, and he's never played.
Absolutely,
that seems quite remarkable.
Nigeria had no shots in the first half and 16 in the second.
They clearly got a rocket at half time from the match, clearly, because they tore out of the traps in the second half and scored almost immediately, didn't they? So Mr. Roar obviously roared at them in the dressing room.
I wouldn't bet against Iceland to still go through. On the other hand, Croatia has already qualified. They're going to play reserve team in the last game.
They could do.
So they probably will. They probably will do.
Qualification is still out of Argentina's hands, okay? Croatia are already through. All the other three nations can advance. Argentina must beat Nigeria in their final game, but their progress will still depend upon Iceland v Croatia. Iceland currently have a better goal difference than Argentina. If they defeat Croatia and the win is better than Argentina's, they will qualify. The last time Argentina were knocked out of the World Cup at the group stage was 1962. And can I just compliment whoever tweeted this yesterday? I think Argentina will lose. I really do. Have a wee wedge on Croatia. If I'm going to be wrong, get your lazy, biased journo tweets in before the game starts. No interests in profits of the past. Après final whistle. Barry, well done.
Yes, I'm a soothsayer. Even a blind squirrel finds the occasional nut
Producer Jonathan won 70 quid off that, apparently. Well,
good for him.
Well done. And can we have a moment's silence for the Argentinian TV, who, after their defeat, held a minute's silence in the studio, as if Pugac, Wright, Bilic and Roy Keane would stand there inside. I mean, I don't know who would have to have lost.
I mean,
for those.
Some of them you probably wish they would.
I quite like that setup. So we'll finish part two with a moment of silence for the Argentina TV, because Argentina could still win the World Cup and they've done a minute's silence. It's completely ridiculous. Anyway, silence, please. And that's part two. We'll be back in a tick. Welcome to part three of the Guardian World Cup Football Daily. Let's look ahead to tomorrow's games. Belgium-Tunisia in England's group. Paolo, how do you see this one?
I expect Belgium to win. I suppose my gut instinct is that they'll win comfortably, but it was interesting seeing them in that first game against Panama. I mean, they were manifestly better than Panama, and you always felt like they were going to end up winning. And in the end, 3-0 looked quite convincing. And yet, at the same time, It never quite flowed. You never quite thought, well, this is, and this has always been the question with this team, right? They're one of those teams that actually, if you go through the 11, you think that's got to be one of the strongest in the whole tournament. But has it ever quite looked like it's one of the best 11s together in world football? I don't know yet, but I Tunisia were very open at the back against England, and with that amount of attacking talent coming up, I think they should win comfortably.
The difference being that England is very, very sharp and quick. Ahead, in front, which is not what I would say of Belgium, whom I find very stodgy, ponderous, very slow to build up. The transitions are very, very, very slow indeed. They're still trying to find a way to use Kevin De Bruyne's qualities in that team. It's not very imaginative. And I think they were really flattered by this 3-0 scoreline, which shows they've got, you know, this confidence. A bit like the French, basically. They haven't been convincing at all, but they've won and scoring. And they've got also a rare thing in this World Cup, which is a proper goal scorer and striker in Romelu Lukaku. And you would imagine that it's going to be a bit tough for this quite awkward and niggly Tunisia team. Which we shouldn't forget created close to absolutely zero chance. I think did they create a single chance against England?
Well, they scored, but yes.
Well, that was not. That was they scored on a penalty, which was, shall we say, a bit generous. Mm. Did they create anything?
I can't recall. Kompany and Vermaelen are injured. Probably no surprise to anyone. So Boyata,
they wouldn't have played anyway. So
Boyata's playing in a three with Alderweireld and Vertonghen. Tunisia's goalkeeper Moez Hassan, who went off after 16 minutes against England, has been ruled out of the tournament. So with that shoulder injury, which is a shame for him.
Well, I agree with the lads that despite beating Panama 3-0, I was very unconvinced by Belgium. And I think Panama are, by a distance, and I may well be leaving someone out here, the worst team in the tournament. They're really bad, really slow, really ponderous. And I think Tunisia, while they will probably lose, I think they might make life difficult for Belgium. I wouldn't be hugely surprised if it was a draw.
All right. Also tomorrow, South Korea play Mexico. We can talk to Mexican football expert Tom Marshall. Tom, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Just counting down to the game.
What was the reaction after that win against Germany? Because it was, I don't know if anyone in Mexico expected it, because I don't think anyone else did.
Not really. I mean, it just all came together. And I think the reaction, honestly, within Mexico and the Mexican press, the reaction has been like, almost like the manager, Juan Carlos Osorio, came into the game, you know, really not very popular. And it's almost like, oh, you know, forgive us, Osorio, for not trusting in you. And, you know, you've shown at the World Cup that all the preparation, all the rotations, all the experiments, you know, coming into the tournament was because you had an absolute plan of how to get a result against Germany, and it just came together. So euphoria. I mean, the biggest result in the history of Mexico in the World Cup. I mean, there's no doubt about that. It was absolutely huge.
You said in the previews that we did with you that Mexico would attack from the first minute, but you couldn't have expected it to go quite that well.
No, I mean, I think Germany obviously played into Mexico's hands. But Osorio he knew what he was doing. He knew that the German fullbacks pulled up, and he knew that with, you know, players like Irving Lozano on the wing that they could do some real damage. And that's exactly how it went. It was surprising to see a German side that were so naive in a way, because it's not kind of an adjective you'd describe German teams as usually. But yeah, it went exceptionally well. And I don't know, I mean, there's something, I don't know, kind of inspiring about watching a team that obviously play for play isn't as talented as someone like Germany, but is willing to take a risk and have a go and throw players forward. So I think, that's all fed into a real wave of positive and really around the Mexican national team now.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you imagine South Korea might actually defend, unlike Germany.
Yeah, I think they'll try. But yeah, I think, coming into this game, Mexico, for me, definite favourite. The word from the camp is obviously there's a lot of confidence. But they've been very, very careful. They've had meetings built in the lead up to this game to just make sure that, there's not overconfidence, that they don't think the job's done. But to be honest, the Mexican Federation hired a mental coach back in, October 2016. And the mental aspect of the game has been something that they've been working really hard on in group meetings, individually. And I think the message that they're sending out, even from before this tournament, is that they're here to win it. They're here to reach the final and win the World Cup. And so they've set the bar pretty high for themselves.
South Korea weren't particularly good in their opening game against Sweden. Mexico were shocked everyone, as you said. Will the Mexican fans be expecting the same performance again, do you think? And do you think Mexico are capable of delivering a performance that good again?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's not going to be as entertaining because I think Korea are going to sit back. I don't think they're going to restrict the spaces as much as possible. And the Mexican team, basically, that's what they rely on. If you give them space, then they can really do you damage. So I mean, I think that's the big issue going into the game. How will Korea approach it? But let's not forget, Korea need a win as well. I mean, they can't be sitting back and we're hoping for a draw because, if they do that, then the World Cup's over. So I think they'll be looking for a lot more from Son. I was at the game in Nizhny Novgorod the other day, and I don't know, the style just completely didn't suit him. It's like almost the opposite of the way Tottenham play, with the high pressing and stuff. And Korea were just sat so deep that Son couldn't really get into the game. So, I think that Mexico are obviously going to be confident. And we'll see if Juan Carlos Osorio, he's known for his rotations. We'll see if there are going to be, I expect there to be three or four changes from the starting 11 against Germany. So everyone here in the press centre right now, all the Mexican press, we're all trying to guess what the team's going to be. But we don't usually get it right, I'm not going to lie.
Tom, I wanted to ask for a quick word on Carlos Vela. He's obviously someone who Arsenal fans familiar with, Premier League fans familiar with from his time here, but he's sort of had this slightly, I don't know, odd trajectory of a career, because back in sort of 2005, he was, I guess, the star of the team that won the Under-17 World Cup, and he was going to be the next sort of great thing. And maybe he never quite reached the level that was imagined for him then, but yet here he is now, and he feels very central to this team, which, as you've just said, is a team with great ambitions for this World Cup.
Yeah, I think Carlos Vela, if you look at it talent-wise and what he's capable of, for me, is the most talented Mexican player. I mean, sometimes you watch him play when he's on form, and, one of those players who sees passes that, you don't even see in the stands. He's got something a little bit special about him, but the problem is he's not, I don't know, for example, Vela prefers watching a game of basketball than a game of football. He sees playing football as kind of is a job. He goes there, he tries hard, he does it, but he's not kind of in love with the game. And I think we've seen that the way that he's moved from Real Sociedad to LAFC. I mean, obviously the money's good over there in MLS, but, he's never, for example, Antoine Griezmann, when a couple of years ago when it was Real Sociedad were in the Champions League, and it was Vela and Griezmann, and they were both looked really, really strong. And then you look at Griezmann, who goes to Atletico Madrid and obviously gets the interest from Barcelona and the ambition that he showed and the development. And then you look at Vela, who at that point a few years ago looked like he could also make that step up to a really giant club. And I just think it's that, 1%, that 0.5% of really, really wanting it. And I don't think Vela is particularly, I think that's the thing he lacks more than anything else. And I think that's what kind of held him back a little bit in his career.
Tom, one slightly sour note is this, the homophobic chanting from the Mexican fans. Mexico have been fined 10,000 Swiss francs. That's about £7,500. It's not the first time, is it? What's the deal with this chant, and how are they trying to get it stamped out?
Yeah, I mean, the Federation are trying the best. It's something that goes on in every Mexican league game. it's kind of ingrained in the footballing culture. It's not like the fans come over here and then suddenly start doing it. I mean, it's been going on for quite a while as well. But yeah, it's ongoing, and it's just difficult to stop. It looks like actually being in Rostov over the last few days, the fans are kind of trying to create a new chant. So we'll see if actually when it comes to the stadium, whether they do change it. But you know, it's completely wrong. It's not something that's positive anyway. The one thing I would say though, kind of in the cultural context, I don't know. It's kind of almost like cabaret. I don't know. It's not kind of a. I don't think the majority of people chanting it are using it in a homophobic way. Don't get me wrong. That doesn't make it right at all. But it is kind of it does have a cultural context there within Mexico. Like it's almost like lucha libre. If you go to the lucha libre wrestling match in Mexico, it's part of kind of the show, if you know what I mean. And obviously there are a lot of Mexico fans. I think if you ask most Mexico fans, they don't think there's anything wrong with it, and that's basically the problem. I mean, you've got FIFA on one hand who are saying this is homophobic, it's wrong, and then you've got the Mexico fans on the other saying, you know, this is done tongue in cheek. This isn't kind of something that's taken so seriously by us. But you know, it's a no-win really for both sides, because I mean, what do FIFA do at this point? Do they dock points? Because if they want to be really serious about it, then all they have to do is come out and say, if we hear this game tomorrow in Rostov, then we're docking your points. And I'm pretty sure at that point, the Mexican fans wouldn't do it.
Tom, great to speak to you as always.
Thanks a lot.
Tom Marshall there. Enjoy the game as well. Tom Marshall there, Mexican football expert. FIFA has a zero-tolerance approach to discrimination, a spokesperson said, Philip.
Yeah, that's interesting, because obviously it's a policy that they can apply to a few chants in the crowd and not necessarily to the host country, where, as you know, there is a law which is throughout the whole of the Russian Federation, which makes it's a criminal offence to be a propagandist for homosexuality. And it's actually a crime, full stop, in one of the parts of the federation, which is Chechnya, where basically being LGBT puts you in grave danger. So obviously it's like FIFA doing its usual thing. It was not a daily reminder, but I think a reminder of that we shouldn't be fooled by everything we see at the moment.
Fair enough. The other game tomorrow is Germany versus Sweden. Apparently there is a crisis in the Germany camp, according to Sport Built, so not necessarily the most reliable source. There are factions within the Germany team. One faction's been dubbed the Bling Bling Gang, which comprises of Mesut Ozil, Kedira, Boateng and Draxler. The other is the Bavarians, Neuer, Hummels, Müller and Kroos. And the Bling Bling Gang are upset with the Bavarians that they didn't... I don't know if anyone listens to Atletico Mintz, but it's sat with returning into that.
The Bavarians sounded really like a kind of 70s supergroup. Yeah. What was it again? Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, the equivalent
Neuer, Hummels, Müller and Kroos. The Bling Bling Gang are upset with the Bavarians for not pushing Yogi Löw to take Leroy Sané. That's apparently the crux of this, which if the pod was to split into gangs, Barry, would you be in the Bling Bling one?
Well, I wouldn't be in the Bling Bling one because I don't wear bling, but I also wouldn't be in the Bavarian one because I'm not Bavarian and I don't play for Bayern Munich. So I'd probably set up my own little faction, the Shamrockers.
Is that you and Paul Doyle?
Yeah.
Oh, that, I mean, not a bad one to be in, to be fair.
Well, I'd like, you know, if you want someone to have your back, Doyle is the man.
Producer Jonathan says you could be Bavarian.
Yeah, that's true.
It's not bad, is it? How do we see this going, Paolo?
Yeah,
I mean Germany could be out by tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely, and okay. I think probably like most people, I'm expecting a reaction. There's certainly, I'll be fascinated to see what the lineup is. You think about guys like Sami Khedira, who was just a tremendous disappointment in that first game. I think that Germany looked really blunt up top in that game, and I don't by any means pin that all on either the absence of Sané or Timo Werner, who sort of is the guy who's perhaps was always, when you looked at that lineup, you look, okay, he's the newer face, he's the one who's got something to prove. But what's interesting about that is they managed to look blunt up top whilst also managing to leave themselves quite open at the back, because Mats Hummels off the back of the game was saying, look, me and Jerome Boateng were basically left as a two the whole time. I think that you would expect, certainly from what we've seen in Sweden through qualifying, them to be less adventurous than Mexico. I think Mexico definitely caught Germany off kilter a little bit by the way they attacked so aggressively from the start of that game. But there is a little part of me that thinks if Germany can't work out how to break down an opponent and they're playing against a team that's extremely good at not being broken down, yeah, there is a chance that this ends up in, who knows, maybe in the first 0-0 of the tournament. But they need to find some answers that they didn't have in that first game.
It was absolutely brainless. The distance between Hummels and their midfielders was sometimes 40 to 50 yards. And it was one of the most brainless performances I've seen from a top team since the performance by England against Germany in South Africa. You might remember it was 2-1. Lampard scores the goal that he's not. And then England just goes crazy in the search for a second goal, leaving huge amounts of space, which is exactly what Germany did in that game. The one player I think has a stake to start would be Brandt for me. I mean, he really genuinely made a big difference when he came on. He looked really fresh. He's full of imagination. He's been one of the players in the season in the Bundesliga. And he looked different. But otherwise, my goodness, the problem is the midfield. And I know the record. I mean, we were checking that. I think the record of Sweden against Germany is pretty poor. Actually, it's worse than poor. They've never beaten them, have they, Barry, I think?
No, never. We checked beforehand.
Yeah, so you would say...
A few draws, but no wins.
But it's the atmosphere, and dare I say, I mean, the fact that Löw was totally outthought by Osorio, I mean, his prestige would have taken a big knock for that, because the Mexicans really beat them with their brains as much as anything else.
Mikael Lustig, obviously plays for Sweden and Celtic, posted this on Instagram. Notifications that came on his phone from Aftonbladet, two notifications within 6 minutes. The first announced three arrests after a murder in Malmo. The second announced that three Swedish players were missing training.
Oh dear.
We don't believe there's any connection to that. Thank you for this tweet from Matthew WCR, who says, World Cup fever level distracted by the greatest name for a football club ever. This is in international club friendlies. They lost 11-0 to Club Bruges, but they are called KFC Heist, which is a lovely name for a football team. And we're going to...
They were robbed.
Very good. Robbed by some chickens, hopefully. Some praise for you, Barry, to finish the pod. Mark says, I firmly believe that Barry doing the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air is better than Des Lynam doing If by Rudyard Kipling. Tor says, I rather worryingly realising I'm developing a serious man crush on Barry. That voice makes me tingle in places it's not supposed to.
Oh, dear.
And anyway, here's a choice for you, okay? And it's for Paolo and Philippe to choose how Barry ends the pod.
Okay.
David writes, after his monotone rendition of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, any chance of singing another American sitcom classic in Cheers, please, Barry? Send me to sleep a happy man on Wednesday. More of the same, please. So the theme to Cheers, Quentin simply wrote, Barry, please, My Humps by the Black Eyed Peas. Which would you prefer?
Much though I feel like Baz would object more to My Humps and therefore I should make him do that, I'd quite like to hear Barry do Cheers.
So would I, actually.
Okay. Philippe,
at least I've heard this.
Philippe, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much,
Paolo. Thanks so much for your time.
Cheers,
ladies and gentlemen. Reading in his own laconic way, Cheers. It's Barry Glendenning.
Making your way in the world today takes everything you've got. Taking a break from all your worries sure would help a lot. Wouldn't you like to get away? Sometimes you want to go where everybody knows your name, and they're always glad you came. You want to be where you can see, our troubles are all the same. You want to be where everybody knows your name. You want to go where people know, people are all the same. You want to go where everybody knows your name. You want to go where people know, people are all the same. You want to go where everybody knows your name.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.